It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. State education leaders seek ways to boost low reading proficiency scores among Wisconsin students. We learn about what schools may use to teach children how to read and a science-backed approach. You can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Laura Adams is a policy initiatives advisor for the State Department of Public Instruction. Laura, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you so much for the invitation to be here today.
Yes. So your department is asking the state legislature's budget writing committee to approve 11 early literacy curricula for kindergartners through third graders. Why is the agency seeking approval of these reading materials versus some other options?
I think first it's just important to take a step back and look at the bigger context that this list is a part of. And that is part of some new legislation that was passed this summer, known as Act 20. And the reason why this legislation was passed is because we all know that developing reading skills is critical, both to a child's academic success and their future life success. And we know based on our state data that while there have been some pockets where our learners are succeeding in developing those early critical reading skills, we also know that we can all do better, which is why the Department of Public Instruction worked collaboratively with our legislators to really reimagine the way that literacy is taught to our schools. And there are a lot of things in this complex and comprehensive piece of legislation. This legislation changes what instruction our future teachers are getting around reading in their colleges and universities. It requires all of our early educators and administrators to participate in a specific kind of reading training. This legislation allows for a limited number of statewide early literacy coaches to support our schools that have the greatest early literacy needs. And it also provides for a single reading readiness assessment that all learners in public and independent charter schools will be taking so that we have some data points that we can look at, and especially for those learners that experience high mobility, schools will have the best information about them in order to provide the most meaningful instruction.
And so,
but the most important piece of this legislation, the real foundation, is the fact that there's a clear definition of science-based early literacy instruction, which clearly delineates what needs to be taught as far as reading skills to our youngest learners. And then that is what our recommended list is connected to.
And Laura, you know, it seems like with the science of reading, teaching phonics seems to garner, you know, a lot of the spotlight. Are there other strategies in a science-based approach on learning to read?
Yeah, I really appreciate that question. And this is something that I'm really proud of Wisconsin for doing. There were some states that have passed similar legislation that just focused on phonics. But what we know from the research and evidence is that phonics alone is not enough to build critical reading skills. We also need to focus on oral language development and building vocabulary and background knowledge of learners, which comes through other kinds of subject area content like science and social studies. And we know that writing instruction is deeply connected because that's a reciprocal process between reading and writing. And so that's one thing I'm really proud of Wisconsin for doing, is establishing a really comprehensive definition, which is ultimately what the department used in our review of the early literacy instructional materials.
Laura Adams is with us, Policy Initiatives Advisor for the State Department of Public Instruction, as we explore Wisconsin's work to transition to new state guidelines for reading curriculum and early readers. You can join in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. So, Laura, how would schools choose which reading materials to adopt?
That is an excellent question. I mean, right now, the way that the process works is that all local school boards have the independent authority to adopt whatever early literacy curricula they want, and they spend a great deal of time reviewing instructional materials based on their local criteria. And what this piece of legislation does is it tries to make that process easier. Remember that, as I said, the law clearly delineates what are the criteria for science-based early literacy instruction, and the law required the formation of a council, the Early Literacy Curriculum Council, with three members appointed from the Speaker of the Assembly, three members appointed by the Senate Majority Leader, and three members appointed by the Department of Public Instruction. And the statute defined their job to review early literacy instructional materials and then to make a recommended list to the department. By having a list for schools to begin that process with, that really allows our school districts to establish any additional local criteria based on the needs of their local learners and their local communities, to make their process a little bit easier at the local level.
So this nine-member education council, they come forth with four curriculum choices. The Department of Public Instruction struck one of those recommendations from its list. What is problematic about the recommendation that was called Bookworms by Open Up Resources?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think first it's really important to acknowledge that this council faced a lot of challenges, even for professionals who analyze curriculum as part of their daily roles and responsibilities. That's a complex process. This council had a really short deadline. Their deadline in the law said that they had to present a recommended list to the department by December 1st. And they chose to go beyond what was delineated in the law to establish their review criteria. But in the stress of their shortened timeline, they failed to norm as a group on the rubric that they established. They were engaging in some open conversation about a predetermined number of instructional materials that might make a good recommended list. And all of that really exposed Wisconsin to a level of legal risk that required that the department then engage in our own independent review of the instructional materials. And as I said, the department was using exactly what the law states must be required in science-based early literacy instruction. And the law also states that those components need to be both explicit and systematic. And you can see our reviews publicly posted online. Our independent reviews just found that some of the components that are listed in the law were not met to our satisfaction in that particular set of instructional materials, or perhaps there was evidence that it was missing that explicit piece of instruction.
What do you
in
mean?
Some of those components.
Yeah, what do you mean by explicit and systematic?
Yeah, that's a great question. So systematic is really that idea that there's a pre-established scope and sequence. If I'm an early literacy teacher, I don't teach about the CH combination. I don't do that just because I feel like it. I do that because that's part of a very well-established scope and sequence, and it makes sense just based on the progression of the skills that are being taught. Mm-hmm. So that's the systematic piece. And then explicit is that when I provide that instruction, I'm very clearly explaining to students what the instructional goal is and why we're learning about it, and providing some explicit instruction in maybe how to make that sound by providing instruction on what do I do with my mouth, and providing some really clear instruction at a level that those early learners can understand about when we use that perhaps when we use that particular combination of letters.
Oh, thank you for that explanation. Laura Adams is a policy initiatives advisor at the State Department of Public Instruction as we discuss reading instruction methods in Wisconsin and the rollout. Be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore the latest efforts to help struggling young readers in Wisconsin and new instructional methods that schools may consider using, like an emphasis on phonics. Call in with a question. You can add your perspective. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Laura Adams is with us, Policy Initiatives Advisor at the State Department of Public Instruction. Laura, under the state law that set in motion this transition to new reading guidelines, schools must shift from balanced literacy to science of reading curricula. What is the difference between balanced literacy and science of reading methods?
I think that the answer to that question really depends on who you ask, to be honest. I think that it can be really easy to get hung up on those terms like balanced literacy. Sometimes we hear whole language, even though those terms whole language and balanced literacy refer to two different things. They're often very confused or conflated in the early literacy conversation. Science of reading very often includes the perspective of a more phonics focused approach to early reading instruction. But you'll also find that people who subscribe to balanced literacy will say that they also believe in a phonics focused approach to early literacy instruction. And that's why I think it's so helpful that our legislation actually names science-based early literacy instruction and then very clearly and comprehensively delineates exactly what that means and names all of the components that must be a part of that. And that way we don't need to get hung up on conversations or debates about some of those early literacy terms.
How long will teachers have to be able to undergo training on their school's new reading curriculum once it's set?
Yeah, that probably not long. And this was definitely a stressful part of the process. The reality of a school budget cycle and the reality of a school calendar means that any Wisconsin district that does want to purchase new early literacy instructional materials and get those in the hands of learners for next school year, they need to be making those purchases now. And so that was definitely something that added stress to the entire process. And so it's also an important reminder that in Wisconsin, districts are not required to select any of those early literacy curricula from the recommended list. They are required to implement science-based early literacy instruction as it's delineated in the law. So so at this point in time, we are waiting for the Wisconsin Joint Committee on Finance to approve a final recommended list because they are the body that has the authority to do that. At this point, the council has recommended a list and the department has recommended a list, but we need to wait for that Joint Committee on Finance. And as soon as that happens, which we're hoping it will be very soon, then school districts can begin that process of purchasing if they choose to do that. And will likely be able to begin that process of professional learning on how to use those materials effectively, maybe this summer, certainly next fall. And of course, that is the key, right? Because there is no silver bullet set of instructional materials. Mm-hmm. I mean, get any instructional materials that you want in the hands of teachers, but if they are not supported with ongoing professional learning on early reading practices and how to use those materials, a school is not going to see the positive impacts that they want to see.
Talking with Laura Adams, Policy Initiatives Advisor at the State Department of Public Instruction, as we talk about Wisconsin's transition to new state guidelines for reading curriculum. Call in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Tom is here in Green Bay. Hello, Tom.
Good morning. My question is about the Give a Kid a Book program that the Brown County Library runs every year, and our Green Bay Area Retired Men's Club donates quite a bit of money to that. And I just wondered if there's any measurable results from that program. That's all.
Tom, thank you. The Give a Kid a Book program, would this support the activities happening in the classroom, Laura?
It absolutely would. And first of all, just what an amazing program. And I know that so many of our Wisconsin communities have similar programs. And there's also like the Reach Out and Read program. Mm-hmm. And there's definitely evidence that shows that the more books that you provide to our youngest learners from birth, that helps them really develop those critical early literacy skills.
You know, I'm a mom of four, and I know that the on-ramp to reading is different for every kid. And, you know, every child could be supported in a different way for learning to read and write. Would the curricula that is being proposed support that diverse range of learners and have enough interventions and uniqueness for different for kids learning differently?
Yeah, I think that is a yes and kind of answer, because the answer is yes, that all learners will certainly be supported because this list of curricula meets that definition that we have established in our law of what early literacy must look like. And that's based on research and evidence. And at the same time, there are always some learners who need additional supports. And in that case, that it depends on the need of the learner, and they might need some more intensive additional supports beyond just that general universal curriculum. And then that really leads us into the conversation about how well resourced our schools are, because without adequate funding to provide those additional supports, some of our learners who need them may not get them.
Heard from Ed in Madison, called in to say, what interventions are there for struggling readers that work? A lot of money goes into programs, Ed says, but they aren't working and giving results.
Absolutely. And there's, you know, I think, first of all, if we definitively knew exactly what intervention was the right intervention, we wouldn't be here having this conversation. Mm. And there is a great body of research that shows that different interventions work for different learners. And you first have to really do the work of identifying what is the underlying reading skill that is a barrier for that learner. And that's why part of this legislation requires additional diagnostic reading testing when a learner is identified as at risk, so that schools can just really accurately identify what is the underlying reading skill that is a problem for this learner, so that it can be targeted and addressed. And different reading interventions target different specific reading skills.
Laura, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you, Kate.
Laura Adams is a policy initiatives advisor at the State Department of Public Instruction. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We hear from a refugee resettlement agency about its work in the Chippewa Valley and what the new families will mean to the larger community. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about being seen.
What's one of the best ways to combat hate? For Jesus Gregorio Smith of Appleton, it's to push back with love. He shares his story as part of the Home Is Here project, which amplifies the voices of the growing number of Black, Asian, Native American, and Latino residents who call northeastern Wisconsin home.
I saw the sign up on Richmond Street in downtown Appleton, and I couldn't believe my eyes. It was just a sign flashing the F word, the one that rhymes with maggots. It was displayed across a business sign so everyone driving down the road could see it like it was nothing. All I could think about was, how could this be possible? Those poor queer kids who already have a hard time with family within themselves being gay or bi or trans, what happens when they see this sign spewing so much hate? I had to do something. I've experienced my fair share of hatred and bigotry throughout my life. I was born and raised in the little old town of El Paso, Texas. My father, Johnny Smith, is an African-American man who was born in the 1940s during legal segregation. While Dad was stationed at Fort Bliss, he traveled to Juarez, Mexico with his fellow soldiers for drinks and fun nights. It's there he fell in love with my mother, Sonia Smith. Once they were married, they had 5 mixed-race children. I'm the youngest of the 5. I had the luxury and honor of having 2 cultural backgrounds and influences in my life. But that luxury also had costs. I recall the first time I was ever called the N-word, and it was by Mexican folks. And I thought to myself, don't we all have it bad enough? Why are we picking on each other? I'll never forget the time my mother gave me this serious talk in first grade because she was embarrassed with how feminine I was as a child. In fact, the first person to ever call me the F word was my mother. My father instilled a particular vision of Black masculinity that was meant to protect my brothers and I in the world. He stressed that I needed to get a good job in computers in order to be successful. As I got older, I hid my gayness and only pursued paths that would make my family proud, keep me hidden, and keep the comments about me to a minimum. But college didn't lead to a career in computers. Instead, I faced my fears and embraced my identity. I began empowering fellow members of the queer LGBTQIA community. Eventually, I got my PhD in sociology with a focus on race, sexuality, and masculinity. And that's what brought me to Wisconsin, a job at Appleton's Lawrence University as an assistant professor of ethnic studies. Which brings me back to that homophobic sign I saw in downtown Appleton. I didn't let the hate deter me. So when I decided to protest under the sign, I gaited it up even more to be exactly what the sign said I was. I put on a purple wig, a rainbow shirt, white high heels, and danced around to Born This Way by Lady Gaga. I filmed a silly video and took a photo. The photo went viral on social media. Not too long after, numerous Appleton residents showed up to fight against the hate, resulting in it coming down. I took that viral image put it on a shirt, and sold it, and raised $15,000 for the Sexual Assault Crisis Center. That is how you turn that hate into love. Through the process of finding oneself, embracing oneself, and living as one's authentic self, one can counter painful experiences and turn them into something different. I tried to hide myself from pain, but when I bravely faced it, I overcame it. It isn't easy, but I think we deserve to see a different world. Determining your own path, despite what others say, can help you break out of molds that confine you. I eventually embraced who I was and made a huge difference in people's lives, as well as my own.
Jesus Gregorio Smith is an associate professor of ethnic studies at Lawrence University. His story is part of the Home Is Here project from the New News Lab, a local news collaboration in northeastern Wisconsin made of six media organizations, including WPR and the Green Bay Press-Gazette. More information can be found at wisconsinlife.org. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCullum.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Christian humanitarian organization World Relief aims to resettle dozens of refugees this year in the Chippewa Valley. We check in on the effort and explore concerns that have surfaced. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Matthew Sorens is Vice President of Advocacy and Policy at World Relief. Matthew, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Well, bring us up to speed on the resettlement plans for these 75 individuals in the Eau Claire area. What are the details of the resettlement plans?
Yeah, so World Relief has actually been in Wisconsin for more than a decade in the Fox Valley area, actually, where the community where I grew up, and we've been resettling refugees there for many years. And with growth in the overall federal refugee resettlement program, in the light of the greatest mass forced displacement crisis globally that we've seen in history, we were looking for new places where we could potentially resettle refugees. So almost a year ago now, we began a process of looking really around the country, but including through our Appleton office, looking there in Wisconsin for another community where we might resettle a relatively small number of refugees. And after a long process of consulting with local governmental leaders and, you know, school boards, law enforcement, potential employers, apartment owners and landlords, local churches who are really central to our mission as a Christian organization, we proposed Eau Claire as a community where we might begin resettlement. And the federal government under the law has the authority to make those determinations of where refugees are resettled, because refugees are legally defined under federal law as people who have fled their country because of a well-founded fear of persecution, and they have all the authority there. But they approved that request, and so we announced that back in September, that our intention to start resettlement in Eau Claire, and we actually just earlier this month resettled the first family that arrived there in the Eau Claire community. And
how are they doing?
I think they're doing well. It's always the first several weeks after arriving in a totally new country are always a culture shock. And yet we've been really encouraged by the community there in Eau Claire. There's a team from a church that's coming alongside them and helping them with that cultural adjustment. The first few weeks, there's a lot of focus on just getting people on their feet, making sure they have a safe place to live. And then very quickly moving to how do we help children get enrolled in school? How do we help adults find jobs? Refugees are authorized to work from the day they arrive. And fortunately, there's lots of job opportunities right now. In fact, there's labor shortages in Wisconsin. So, we were already in that process of looking at what would be an appropriate job for this family to be able to be economically self-sufficient as soon as possible.
Matthew, what countries will the refugees being resettled in the Eau Claire area, where will they come from?
Yeah, we don't know for sure. The first family was from the Democratic Republic of Congo, and that's probably a pretty good guess of where the top nationality of where we'll see refugees from, just based on where refugees who've been resettled to Wisconsin in the past year have come from. those are decisions that the federal government makes. They do that vetting overseas and verify that someone meets the U.S. legal definition of a refugee. And then we get, you know, somewhere between a few days and a few weeks of notice that a particular family will be arriving. So only at that point do we necessarily know the nationality. So we can't with confidence project, you know, the 75 refugees that we intend to resettle in Eau Claire by the end of September of this year, exactly what countries they'll come from. But based on, you know, the recent trends of where the federal government has sent refugees from to Wisconsin, it would probably be primarily the Democratic Republic of Congo, very likely also Burma or Myanmar in Southeast Asia. And to say that they're coming from those countries, they fled those countries in many cases years or even decades ago, and have often been in a neighboring country in a refugee camp or some other setting.
There have been some reports, including from Fox News, suggesting the majority of refugees are coming from Somalia. Is that true?
Well, again, we don't know for sure where refugees will be coming from, but that's not where we anticipate the majority of refugees will be coming from. Just based on who we've seen thus far in Eau Claire and where we have seen refugees resettled to Wisconsin, you know, in our Appleton office and where our peer organizations in Milwaukee or Madison or Wausau have seen refugees being resettled from in the last few years. I think that rumor probably comes from the proximity to Minnesota, which is a center for Somali resettlement or has been historically. And to be really clear, we'd be happy to receive Somalis if that's who we're sent. We just don't necessarily anticipate that we'll actually be the majority of those who are going to come to Eau Claire. And if we do see Somalis, it will probably be family reunification cases. So where there's someone who was resettled possibly to Minneapolis or another community possibly many years ago. And when a refugee who's been approved by the federal government for resettlement is in that process of, them making travel plans, our government will basically ask them, hey, do you have relatives somewhere already in the United States? And if they say, well, I have a relative in Eau Claire, they're going to be sent to Eau Claire as opposed to somewhere else. And so that would be the most likely situation where we would see Somali refugees would be in family reunification cases if there are already Somalis living, you know, in that region.
That makes sense with family bonds and family support networks already in place. I want to turn to our state legislature passing a bill in recent days that would require local government involvement in refugee resettlement plans. You mentioned early in the process talking with, Eau Claire area, leaders. Has World Relief since then consulted with local officials about resettling refugees?
Yeah, we've, as I said, in the last month or so have resettled our first family in Eau Claire, and we've been talking to governmental leaders for nearly a year. I think in March of 2023 were some of our first conversations. And we've had a number of public meetings there in the Eau Claire area as well that lawmakers, state lawmakers and representatives of federal lawmakers, city leaders have been a part of. And that's exactly how the process should work. In fact, by federal law, before resettlement begins, there's to be a consultation process. So the federal government actually has the authority. The Refugee Act that Congress signed back in 1980, it doesn't actually give local or state governments like a requirement to sign off on or approve of refugee resettlement because it is a federal decision, but it does make clear in federal law that there should be consultation with local and state governments, and that has happened in Eau Claire, and it continues to happen. It will continue to happen on at least a quarterly basis, and frankly, as this is new, we'll be meeting more regularly with local stakeholders, both governmental as well as employers, faith-based organizations, other nonprofit organizations, school board leaders. And that's because refugee resettlement is a community initiative, and it works really well, and it has worked really well in places like the Appleton and Oshkosh area when there's community buy-in, when the community is eager to be a part of welcoming these newcomers to the community and helping them to integrate into the community. So that process started, months ago and is ongoing.
Matthew Sorens, Vice President of Advocacy and Policy at the faith-based humanitarian agency World Relief, as we discuss refugee resettlement. Call in with a question. You can share your perspective at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks to Elaine in Milwaukee, who wrote to us seeking programs on how to help refugees in Wisconsin, and specifically how to support the children who come here. A faith-based refugee resettlement and immigrant services agency aims to resettle 75 refugees this year in the Chippewa Valley. We're in conversation with World Relief's head of advocacy and policy, Matthew Sorens, about this work. You can join in the conversation. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Matthew, Republican State Representative Karen Hurd from Falls Creek is a lead sponsor of legislation that would require local government involvement in resettlement plans. And Hurd says refugees in the Chippewa Valley would likely become dependent on local public services. And here last week on the floor of the State Assembly, Hurd said local officials have an interest in refugees receiving the help they need.
We don't want them homeless. We don't want them without medical care. We want to be able to take care of them. That's up to the local government to decide how to get that done.
And you told PBS Wisconsin the majority of refugees will get jobs and live self-sufficiently. Why are you confident the refugees will gain employment here?
Yeah, I mean, I'm confident that refugees will gain employment because the refugee resettlement program has been happening for more than 40 years at this point. I mean, again, it goes back in a formal way to the Refugee Act that President Carter signed into law back in 1980. And it's been a remarkably successful program. There are, of course, some needs as a new family arrives. You know, on day two or day three, they're not economically self-sufficient. And there are some federal taxpayer dollars that contribute to their integration. But there's actually been all sorts of studies. Again, we have decades of experience with this at this point, and World Relief has been a part of this process since the 70s, where, you know, for the first few years, refugees get some assistance, again, mostly federally funded programs that help them get on their feet. But within a number of years, they go from being net recipients of taxpayer contributions to being net contributors to the tax base. And by 20 years after arrival, according to a study by some economists at Notre Dame, the average refugee adult has contributed $21,000 more in taxes at all levels, local, state, and federal, than the combined cost of governmental expenditures on their behalf over those 20 years. So it's actually an investment from a fiscal perspective in, you know, bringing new people into a community who are going to be workers, who are going to be consumers, who are going to add to the economy overall. And of course, it's also driven by the humanitarian priorities of our country, both at a federal level and in states and communities. And for many Americans, including us at World Relief, it's also deeply rooted in our faith and this desire to be faithful to biblical commands, to welcome strangers, to practice hospitality, to love neighbors. So we think it's actually a huge opportunity for the community. And we've seen that from the city of Eau Claire that's actually been very eager to receive refugees as well as other immigrants. And frankly, new recipients and new residents from other states as well. It's not all about immigrants. They actually want to be a growing community, which most communities want to be because they know that that's in their economic interest.
And so you see economic self-sufficiency after arrival in Wisconsin that is absolutely achievable, not a drain on safety net services for months and years.
No, I mean, and again, we have a long history of this. And if you talk to employers, and we have heard from employers in Eau Claire, just as we have in Appleton and Oshkosh, employers are desperate for workers right now. Wisconsin has a very, very low unemployment rate. That's a good problem, but it is actually a bit of a problem as well. It's part of what has fueled inflation in the last few years. And, you know, we think that refugees can be a part of the solution to that challenge while also providing literally life-saving protections to people who were at risk of persecution in their countries of origin.
We're going to hear another voice here, Democratic State Representative Francesca Hong of Madison, voting against the bill. And Hong said on the assembly floor that the bill would create a pathway for xenophobic people to deny refugees the ability to build homes and raise families in Wisconsin.
You can legislate racism. You can legislate hate. You can legislate discrimination. And that is what this bill is doing.
How do you respond to concerns from lawmakers that the legislation would subject refugees to discriminatory treatment or block their legal settlement?
Yeah, I mean, I think to be fair to Representative Hurd, the sponsor of the bill and others, the bill doesn't, you know, it's relatively neutral in that sense. It's about creating requiring local and local governments to be aware of, and then to hold meetings about refugee resettlement. So that could go either way, right? Those meetings could affirm refugee resettlement, or they could denounce it. I think our perspective is it's a burden on those local governments, especially because the bill would require those meetings to happen within a 100-mile radius of any community where there's even an initial preliminary conversation about the possibility of refugee resettlement. So, you know, when World Relief was exploring a new potential site, we didn't just talk to Eau Claire. We were looking at communities in different parts of Wisconsin. A 100-mile radius around every community where we had a conversation would definitely cover more than half of the state. And there's 2,300 local government units as defined by this bill in the state of Wisconsin. So those preliminary conversations could feasibly have required, if this bill would become law, more than 1,000 required meetings, which then subsequent required additional meetings, all of which would lead to the recommendation of county level resolutions on the question of refugee resettlement. And that is where I have a concern that I think resonates with what we just heard, which is that you'll have communities that are unlikely to ever see a single refugee be resettled into their community who are being encouraged to pass a resolution for or against. And often that will bring out the perspectives of people who are maybe misinformed. And we've seen some of that misinformation at work in Eau Claire in the last few months, you know, saying things about refugees that will be inaccurate. And frankly, I don't want a situation where the people whom we've resettled into Appleton are worried about driving, out to Eau Claire because they'll pass through counties that have passed resolutions, probably based on some misinformation saying that refugees are not welcome here. I mean, I don't want to drive through a community where it's been the formal position of the county government that I'm not welcome. And I don't want any of the families that we've served or resettled to have that experience as well. So that's where, you know, I think that this bill goes too far in terms of pushing for resolutions in places where there's really no reason for people to have an opinion on resettlement that's very unlikely to ever happen in their community.
Matthew Sorens with us, Vice President of Advocacy and Policy at World Relief. Matthew, in our last minute together, how can Wisconsinites better support refugees and especially children who are resettling in communities?
Yeah, I so appreciate that question. This only works with volunteers. It only works with financial support from the community. There's some federal funds that go into this, but it's a public-private partnership, and it's local community members, local churches, and others who make it refugee resettlement function really well. So if people go to worldrelief.org/Wisconsin, they can find out how to get involved, whether in the Chippewa Valley area or in the Fox Valley area. And then we have, you know, peer organizations in Milwaukee and Madison, groups like Catholic Charities and Lutheran Social Services, ECDC and Wausau, that are also doing refugee resettlement and doing similar processes. So we'd encourage you to reach out to whoever is local to you.
It sounds like it's very much a collaborative effort among different organizations.
It absolutely is. And even at the local level, I mean, individual, you know, English language teachers are involved, and employers who see the value in giving someone a first job, landlords who take a risk on someone who doesn't have a credit history yet, but ends up being a great tenant. All those are individuals who are part of helping refugees really get on their feet. And that's been part of the story of Wisconsin. I mean, if you go back to the Munger settlement in the 70s and 80s, it's been a really successful process, and it's still working really well. But it only works when the community is engaged.
Matthew, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Matthew Sorens, Vice President of Advocacy and Policy at World Relief. That's a Christian humanitarian organization. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Former President Donald Trump is at the center of criminal investigations at the state and federal level into his business dealings and political actions. And the U.S. Supreme Court is weighing a Colorado case over whether Trump should be ineligible to be on the ballot due to his role leading up to the January 6th attack on the Capitol. So we examine the legal landscape of a former president and hear from you. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Christine Schabo is an associate professor at Marquette University Law School. Christine, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
So the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments over Colorado removing former President Trump from election ballots over his involvement in the Jan 6 attacks on the U.S. Capitol. Why do Colorado's lawyers say Trump should be disqualified from the ballot?
Well, yes, they say he should be disqualified under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, which basically is a ban on particular officers or officials of the United States government who have previously taken an oath to support the Constitution and yet participated either in an insurrection or have given comfort or aid to enemies of the United States. So they say that that prohibition fits former President Trump and the actions that he took on January 6th.
And so a bit of history here, because the Section 3 of the 14th Amendment traces back after the Civil War. Can you explain that history and how it's been perhaps applied, in the past?
Certainly, and it does have a history that is rooted in the Civil War and fear that people who were once, part of the Confederate States and leaders and fighting against the United States would then become part of the United States government once again, that they would be elected in the southern states and then become part of the federal government. So the idea was to have a ban on that type of office holding for people who had engaged in insurrection. And one of the things that's interesting here is that the Section 3 of the 14th Amendment is grounded in that history, but it hasn't been applied in more recent years. So I think there's an open question as to how it might apply to former President Trump now, but there are certainly strong legal arguments to say that he still should be disqualified under current understandings of that law.
Yes, I mean, with your legal analysis, does the 14th Amendment apply to Trump?
Sure. And there are a couple of different questions that are up in the air for whether the 14th Amendment does apply. So, first and foremost, there's the question of the merits of whether or not he actually engaged in insurrection. And I think that is an argument or an area where there are strong arguments on both sides. On one hand, his acts on January 6th certainly seemed to encourage a mob to descend on and breach the Capitol. On the other hand, he didn't actually go to the Capitol himself. So I think there might be some questions as to the intersection between acts of insurrection and whether what he did was covered by the First Amendment. So that's really the merits. And interestingly, that is something that the Supreme Court shied away from at oral argument. It seemed to look instead for other procedural grounds under which Section 3 of the 14th Amendment might not apply to Trump.
Why do Trump's legal team say that the former president should be allowed to be on the ballot?
Sure. They first of all, say that he did not engage in insurrection. And in addition, they've raised a number of arguments to say that, first of all, Colorado does not have power to enforce Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. They argue that it's not a self-executing amendment and that Congress would need to pass enabling legislation before it could be enforced against President Trump. Another argument they have raised is that the president actually is, or presidency, sorry, is not an office that could be disqualifying for purposes of the 14th Amendment. So under the 14th Amendment, there are bans on future office holding by people who have in the past held certain offices that would require them to take an oath to support the U.S. Constitution. And that ban of prohibition applies to people who have taken an oath as officers of the United States, but it doesn't talk about the president of the United States being one of those officers. So there's an open question as to whether the president of the United States is someone who could be subject to Section 3's disqualification. And that's another one of the arguments that Trump's defenders have raised in his case before the Supreme Court.
Christine Chabot with us, associate professor at Marquette University Law School, as we talk about the constitutional questions that come up by lawsuits involving former President Donald Trump. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. You mentioned, Christine, that the justices in oral arguments were focusing more on procedural explorations. What is your gauge of how the justices responded to the arguments?
After argument, it seemed pretty clear that Trump would probably win either 8-1 or 9-0, that the justices were just looking for some way to reverse the Colorado Supreme Court. And I think this goes not just to the legal merits of the case, but I think here the justices are worried about the consequences of a ruling that would remove Trump from the ballot in Colorado. They are afraid that a decision to remove him from the ballot in Colorado might lead that to happen in other states and have the effect of the Supreme Court deciding the presidential election. And that's something I think they're very reluctant to do in light of what happened several years ago now in Bush versus Gore.
I think it was Justice Brett Kavanaugh who asked the question to Colorado, what about the idea that we should think about democracy and kind of raising concerns about the disenfranchising voters? Is that a tension point here?
It is. And I think the idea is whether the court should take away voters' opportunity to vote for Trump by allowing Colorado to remove him from the ballot. Now, technically, I think there may still be options for write-ins and that sort of thing, but still taking him off the ballot in Colorado could really undermine his presidential campaign and the ability of voters to choose the person that they would like to vote for as the next president of the United States. So that's certainly something that is weighing on the court, and the reason why they don't want to be the ones necessarily to decide the outcome of the presidential election. One of the problems, though, is, you know, depending on how the Supreme Court resolves this case, and this is an argument that's been raised in some of the amicus briefs, is it's possible that if the Supreme Court doesn't resolve this issue now at the primary stage, one thing that could happen is we could have in the general election, Trump could win a majority of the Electoral College, and the issue might come up again when it's time for Congress to certify votes under the 12th Amendment. And there could be still, I think, a further constitutional crisis at that point of how to handle that situation. And there might be a scenario where either Congress or potentially the Supreme Court would be asked to take the presidency away from Trump, essentially, after a majority of the Electoral College had indicated that he should be president. And that might be even more of a problem to interfere at that later point in the process than it is to interfere right now.
Do you fear the creation of that type of storm, a constitutional crisis, where in the certification of the election, that it doesn't go the way it is supposed to go? I mean, how definitive could the U.S. Supreme Court's decision be here?
And this really depends, I think, on the route that the court takes to reverse the Colorado Supreme Court. So, for instance, if the Supreme Court simply said that Colorado as a state does not have authority to enforce Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, that would still leave open the possibility of enforcement at the federal level and possibly, again, by Congress when it is time to certify electoral votes. So that would be kind of kicking the can down the road in a way that might not avoid a crisis in the future. There might be other grounds that the Supreme Court could use, and I'm sure they're thinking carefully about those grounds as a way to potentially resolve this case for good now. One of the grounds that I mentioned earlier, whether the presidency is an office that can subject someone to disqualification for participating in insurrection, that might be an easier way for the court to resolve this dispute. Just say whatever President Trump did when he was president, That isn't something that can disqualify him from holding office again under the 14th Amendment, so that the disqualification just would not apply to Trump. The problem, I think, with that argument is if you think carefully through the history and text of the Constitution, I think that argument is a hypertextual read of the Constitution. If you say that an officer of the United States who has taken an oath to support the Constitution and participates in insurrection is then banned from future office holding, it doesn't make a lot of sense to say that the most powerful officer of the United States, the president, is not included in that particular concept. So I think that is a route the court might try to go to have some certainty, but it is not a legal ruling that I think will be reviewed well in the court of history.
Christine Chabot is an associate professor at Marquette University Law School. As former President Donald Trump campaigns for the White House, we discuss the constitutional questions that surface from his appeals in courtrooms. And you can call in with a question. Share your comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As former President Donald Trump vies to reclaim the White House, we examine criminal indictments and the extent of his legal jeopardy with a constitutional law scholar. You can be part of the discussion. You can call in with a question, share your perspective. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Christine Chabot is an associate professor at Marquette University Law School. Christine, you know, the former president has a complicated legal picture, you know, facing criminal charges in four cases. And in one of the cases, Trump is charged in federal court with seeking to overturn his 2020 election defeat. And Trump attempted to block the charges by claiming immunity. Can you explain what arguments were made by Trump's lawyers to justify those claims of immunity?
Yes, and the immunity arguments are now actually the subject of another case that is currently before the Supreme Court. There was an emergency application for a stay of the current ongoing criminal proceedings after the Intermediate Court of Appeals, the District of D.C., found that he had no valid claim for immunity. So essentially, Trump is arguing that as a former president, he is entitled to immunity from criminal liability for acts taken that were official acts at the outer bounds of his responsibilities as president of the United States. And that was pretty soundly rejected by the D.C. Circuit. I think it will also be ultimately rejected by the Supreme Court. And I think the reason it is rejected is because his claim for immunity is weak for several reasons. So, first of all, the strongest claim for immunity would apply to a sitting president, that if you subject a sitting president to criminal process, that will interfere with that person's ability to carry out their duties of office. But as the D.C. Circuit noted in its opinion denying Trump immunity, there's a distinction between the office of the president and citizen Trump, who is now a former president. So that concern wouldn't apply to pursuing a criminal prosecution against him. The second argument he has is that he should still be entitled to immunity for official acts that he took while in office. But I think here the problem with this particular case is that those official acts were related to interference with the results of the 2020 election. And it wasn't really just focused on the events of January 6th. In this case, the prosecution looks far earlier to, you know, constant challenges to the results of the election in contested states, Wisconsin and other contested states, that went beyond legitimate legal challenges in court to whether certain votes were valid or not, and that Trump conspired with a number of lawyers to use illegitimate means to try and contest the result of elections. For example, it was alleged that he came up with slates of fake electors and tried to have Congress, when it ultimately certified votes on January 6th, accept those fake electors rather than the ones that were officially certified by particular states, Wisconsin and others, in which results had been certified for a Democratic slate of electors instead. So those arguments about him exercising an official role don't really hold up so well, essentially, because there's not an official role for the president in that part of the process of being elected president. Being elected president is up to states, who get to choose their electors by popular votes. And then the final determination of who is president is, under the 12th Amendment, up to Congress to certify and count the votes and see which president had the greatest number of electors. So there's not really an official role for the president in that process. So his claim that he's entitled to immunity for acts taken to try and tamper with that process, I think, doesn't hold up well here. And, you know, I would add, in addition, that you're trying to draw some lines between when is a president entitled to immunity for acts taken in office and when does he cross a line. Mm-hmm. There have been other presidents in the past who have crossed that line, who have engaged in criminal conduct, such as President Nixon. Mm-hmm. And there's understanding under the Constitution that presidents can be subject to criminal acts that they undertake while in office. Indeed, that is probably the reason that President Ford later pardoned Nixon, was the understanding that he too could be subject to criminal liability when he crossed the line and violated criminal laws while in office.
Christine Schabo with us, Associate Professor at Marquette University Law School, as we discuss questions, legal questions being raised by the cases involving former President Donald Trump. Call in with questions. Share your comments. 800-642-1234. So, Christine, we're seeing some of the upcoming trial dates popping up here on the dockets. And I'm just wondering, like, if there is a conviction at a trial, I mean, is that new territory for the U.S.? What should we know about such consequences?
It is new territory, and I think part of it will depend on which criminal case goes first and which one there might be a conviction. And there could be a big difference in the consequences, first of all, just depending on whether the conviction is based on federal law, as the case in the D.C. Circuit they were just discussing, or whether it is one of two cases that are based on state law. Mm-hmm. And if there is a criminal conviction based on state law, those cases are pending right now in New York and Georgia, President Trump, even if you're, or current former President Trump, if he were elected as president again, couldn't pardon himself for those state criminal convictions. So he would be subject to the consequences of those state criminal convictions. There's some question if he were convicted for federal crimes and then still became president, if he would be able to pardon himself potentially and therefore lift the sentence or consequence of being convicted for federal crimes. But it is uncharted territory. We don't know exactly how that would play out. I think one of the reasons that, you know, Trump's big defense in many of these cases is delay is that it would be much easier for him if the criminal cases were not completed by the time he were potentially elected president, then he would have a further argument for immunity that the criminal cases should not be ongoing while he was in office. So I think that's why he's raising a bunch of arguments to try and drag out the proceedings. For example, the federal case about tampering with the election was originally scheduled for trial on March 4th. That is not going to happen now that Trump has raised on appeal arguments that he should just be immune from criminal suit. And while those immunity arguments were ultimately not meritorious ones, they did serve the purpose of
slowing
dragging
down
out the clock and making the process take longer. So I think that is going to be his strategy here, is to try to make all of these criminal cases take as long as possible in order to make sure that there is no conviction before the November elections.
Christine, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Christine Chabot is an associate professor at Marquette University Law School. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As Golf Digest ranks Wisconsin number one in the nation for public golf courses, we discuss the significance of that distinction and how courses are doing here. Call in with a question. You can share your comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sue Shapcott is founder and director of Change Golf Instruction in Madison and a former professional tour player. Sue, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back.
Okay, so Golf Digest listing Wisconsin as the top state in the nation for public courses. What makes our state a quality state for public play?
It's quite amazing, isn't it, really? Wisconsin, with our weather, who'd have thought that, you know, we would be one of the top-ranked, or the top-ranked state? And, you know, I think it's really a combination of a few things. And, you know, we have a very golf-enthusiastic population here in Wisconsin. We have developers who see the opportunity of the land that we have here. So we've got stunning golf courses like, you know, Whistling Straits. And then we have, you know, developers who, you know, are building amazing golf courses like Michael Kaiser and Sand Valley. And my guess is that, you know, once a state starts getting a few courses that become destination and have tour events at them or majors at them, then, you know, it really just kind of feeds and it becomes, you know, a cycle where more developers build and more golfers come. So, I mean, it's a great situation for Wisconsin.
Okay, so you mentioned Whistling Straits in Sheboygan. What are your favorite public courses to play in the state?
Ah, there's so many. I still have a sweet spot for Sand Valley, which is the golf course that, you know, is being developed in Rome, Wisconsin. And they've now got four golf courses out there. And the thing that I love about it is that they are inspired by English heathside courses, which means that, you know, they remind me of home. So, mm-hmm. you know, that is something that I love about the golf courses in, you know, up in Sand Valley.
What makes that play distinctly different than perhaps other courses that don't really follow that heritage?
It's a good question. So what I think that Sand Valley does more than some golf courses is that not only is the golf course design very similar to UK golf courses, but the traditions that they have there are very similar to. So there's caddies, there's, you know, the culture is very kind of welcoming and inclusive. And so, you know, it's just a really friendly place to go. So there's kind of no airs or graces about it.
You know, golf can be, you know, quite an expensive hobby. It doesn't always have to be. Do you have any tips to play golf more on the cheap?
Yeah, that's a good question. And that is the downside of our golf courses being so highly ranked, is that, you know, these golf courses that we're talking about, they are not inexpensive to play. So, you know, the thing to do is look out for deals, look out for last minute opportunities. You know, just calling the golf courses as a single player sometimes gets you on to these great golf courses. In Wisconsin, there are websites that help you find discounted green fees. So all of those things are worth checking out.
We have Sue Shapcott with us, founder and director of the Madison-based Change Gulf Instruction, as we talk about Wisconsin's ranking in the Gulf world. You can join in with questions and comments at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Sue, this Gulf Digest ranking also puts Wisconsin, as you mentioned, in the spotlight, puts our courses here in the spotlight. What other states are really great destinations for Wisconsin golfers? What would you recommend?
Michigan always gets ranked really high, which, you know, is also interesting considering the weather there. And so, you know, if you want something local, then Michigan is a great place. I have many students who go to Michigan for a weekend or a week and just play golf courses there. So that's another great place. In a state that's full of fantastic public golf courses. If you want to go further afield, then I really like the Pacific Northwest. You know, the golf courses there, very rugged, very kind of Scottish and Irish-like. So, you know, the likes of Bandon Dunes is you know, really, I think, a bucket list trip. But if you want something closer to home, then Michigan is really good.
What are courses doing to improve the player experience and not only retain golfers, but attract new golfers into the sport?
Yeah, so since the pandemic, then golf has really had a golf boom. Golf was a very safe place for people to congregate during the pandemic, and that boom has continued. So we've got a really big influx of new golfers. We've also got, I think in 2023, it was the first time ever that more people played golf off course than on course. So meaning in golf simulators, meaning just on driving ranges with technology. And so I think there was over 30 million people that played off course golf last year compared to just under 30 million that played on course. Now we've got a great opportunity to bring those off course golfers onto traditional courses, but you know, golf doesn't always make that easy. You know, we still have problems in making people feel that they belong in golf courses. So, you know, we can do a lot still to improve the culture, make people who aren't used to being in a golf environment feel a little bit more welcome. But it's a great opportunity for us to bring more people into the game and make the game more inclusive than it has been in the past.
Sue, that's really curious about people playing golf at driving ranges and virtual bars and things like that off traditional golf courses. What do you think is behind that trend?
I think it's a couple of things. I think that it's cheaper, number one. I mean, for example, in many of these simulated golf environments, you could play in Hawaii one day, then you could play at Whistling Straits the next day, you could play at St. Andrews the next day. So these simulators are kind of loaded with software where you can play all around the world on the top golf courses all around the world. You know, just a fraction of the cost of actually playing them physically. So, you know, you have that aspect to it. It's also a lot more time efficient. So you can play 18 holes of golf in a simulator probably in 2 hours instead of 4 or 5 hours, which it takes on a typical golf course. So I just think it's more accessible for people in terms of cost and time. And it's, you know, if that's a good entry point for people to come into the game, then I think that's great.
Have you tried them?
Yeah, I love them. Yeah. I play there for the same reasons that other people do. It's a lot faster and it's less expensive. I don't have to travel anywhere. So it's really fun. It's a good way of spending time with friends too.
You know, speaking of technology, are there any good golfing apps or any types of technology that are helping people improve their game?
Oh, there are so many that have come on the market in the last few years. So let's say that you did go and play at Whistling Straits or Sand Valley, then, you know, before you go, you can use technology to kind of map out and plan how you want to play the course. There's golf wearables that get to know your game, your clubs, how far you hit, different, you know, different clubs. And so then when you do go and play at these high-end public golf courses, then your app can be your caddy. It knows your game and it can tell you what club to hit where, so it can give you strategy. So, you know, you can really make the most of the experience. So there's, wow, there's technology for that. There's technology, even if you go to a simulator to practice. And I've been doing a lot of teaching inside this year over at Blind Shot Golf on the Near East Side. And they have a technology called TrackMan. And TrackMan is the gold standard for ball flight analysis and launch monitors. And so it gives me all of the data points that I need to know about a golfer and their swing. So it could be their club head speed, the direction that they're swinging in, the club face angle when they hit the ball, the angle that the club swings down at the ball on. And so with students, I can identify one aspect of their golf swing, and we can measure it using TrackMan. And then when they go away and practice, then they can just focus on that number. And so they can quantifiably see how their swing is changing. So, you know, teaching has evolved a lot because of technology.
Wow, so data rich. And then machine learning in your golf game as well. So, you know, last year, the U.S. Golf Association announces it would be changing the makeup of golf balls to reduce how far they travel when you hit them. What are the ramifications of that decision?
Oh, it's been a very laborious discussion in terms of what the governing bodies are going to do to make golf courses viable in the future. So what I mean by that is that at the elite end of golf, particularly in the men's game, then golfers are hitting the ball a lot further. Technology has gotten better. Technique has gotten better. Golfers are stronger. And so what has been happening is that professional players on tour have basically been outpowering traditional golf courses. And so the game has become less exciting because golfers can just hit it so far that there's, you know, what's lost has been elements of skill. And so the governing bodies have been trying to figure out ways to limit how far players hit the ball to make the game a bit more interesting again. So what they have decided to do is limit the flight of the ball. There was a lot of discussion for a while about having some kind of bifurcation where you would have one ball for elite players, professional players, and another ball for amateur players. They did not decide to do that. They just decided to limit the ball across the board. In my opinion, based on my own game and people who I teach, the last thing I need and they need is a golf ball that doesn't go as far. So I think that it hurts recreational golfers, and I'm not sure how much it limits the elite golfers. So we'll see how it plays out. I think the new rule comes into effect in 2025. But, you know, I think that at my end of the game, then players actually need balls and technology can help them hit the ball further to make the game a little bit easier rather than technology that limits the ball. So I'm not necessarily a fan of this solution, but we'll see how it goes.
Sue Shapcott with us, former pro tour player, leads Change Golf Instruction in Madison as we discuss Wisconsin as a golf destination. Be part of the conversation. Call in with a question. You can share your perspective. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the ADS Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin golf courses are negotiating this roller coaster of weather conditions and unseasonably warm weather. And so we check in on the sport and how public courses are doing. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Sue Shapcott is here, a former pro tour player and leads Change Golf Instruction in Madison. Sue, in terms of this weather, and I'm sure we're interfering with your time on the course on such a warm day, what effect does winter golfing have on course maintenance and on the greens?
Yes. I mean, this weather is just amazing. So the driving ranges aren't open yet. So don't worry, you're not stopping me from getting out to work. It's really caught all of us by surprise. A lot of the courses don't have their golf carts delivered yet, which is why the driving ranges tend not to be open and we don't have our equipment to pick up balls. And even if we did have them, then it's a question of whether you would want golf carts out. The golf courses are still going to be really wet. There's not going to be too much growth in the grass yet. And so the golf courses usually rested a lot more than they will be this year. So it's going to be interesting to see how they hold up with, if they get a lot of play early in the season.
Well, the publication Wisconsin Golf is keeping tabs on courses around the state and reporting that these temps have led more than two dozen courses to open and remain open as conditions are allowing. How typical is it for courses to open and close in winter months?
During the fall, I've been here in Madison for 10 years. During the fall, then we often have the courses close and then we get a warm spell and then we open back up again. And so we just kind of squeeze some more rounds out of the season that end. This has been my first year where we've been ready to go before April. So it's new territory for me. In my experience, it's very unusual. I'm not ready to get going. My team of instructors isn't ready to get going. The golf courses aren't necessarily ready to get going. We don't usually staff up this early in the summer. So, if this trend continues, then, it's really going to shake up how we operate as golf courses and operators here in Madison.
How do you think climate change is affecting our state's golf courses?
Oh, that's a big question. I'm not sure I'm really qualified to answer that with any intelligence. But, from a business perspective, then, our season could get extended, which, if the goal is to increase the bottom line and get more revenue, then that's good for golf. If we're thinking about the, bigger and deeper implications of the golf courses being open for longer, then, it's not so good. It's quite, it's quite alarming.
Sue Shapcott with us, founder and director of Madison-based Change Golf Instruction. As we talk about the game and we talk about courses and this weather, you can join in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Sue, the National Golf Foundation is reporting that the number of Black, Asian, and Hispanic golfers is up by over 40% since 2018, and the number of women players rose by 23% over that same period. What do you think is drawing more historically underrepresented people to the sport?
To public golf courses, then I think that having public access golf courses is really good for making our sport more inclusive. Now, by comparison, where I came from in the UK, then even though golf is more affordable, then the way that the system is set up there is it's very much club-based. And so while the US has seen this big growth in diversity in who plays golf, it hasn't been reflected in the UK. And so, I'm left thinking that the way that golf is structured in the US, having more public golf courses and less kind of club structure is really helping us diversify golf. And if we go back to the off-course golf, the simulator golf, then, in terms of women golfers of color, then we are seeing a lot more growth in those areas with off-course golf. And so I think that that could be an entry point for non-traditional golfers, you know, underrepresented golfers, and they get the bug in, you know, a more relaxed environment. And then, you know, that feeds through into more traditional golf. So I think it's a combination of thing, but it's all really exciting to see.
It makes me wonder what the future holds for the country club, a private model for golf.
It is going to be interesting. My guess is that there's always going to be a need and a niche for country club golf. You know, again, thinking about why Wisconsin does so well with public golf courses, you know, my perception is that Midwesterners aren't necessarily as keen on their country club golf as, you know, maybe East Coast elite places are. But, you know, I think that public golf is going to continue to grow, but I think there probably will always be a need for and a market for private country clubs.
Well, Sue, just in our last moments together, you know, people might be stepping foot back on the golf course in these temps. Is there some good exercises for golfers as they get ready to play?
Yeah. Golfers are notoriously bad at doing any kind of warm-up before they play. And, you know, and so really anything to get moving. So arm circles, leg swings, you know, just a bit of twisting. You just want to get blood moving through your body before you start swinging. So no static stretches. So, you know, don't hold a stretch for kind of 30 seconds. Just get your body moving. So get, you know, dance, quick walking, you know, just move your arms around. Anything to get your blood moving would be good.
Sue, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. It's nice to chat to you.
Yes, Sue Shapcott is founder and director of Change Golf Instruction and a former professional tour player. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.